Today is November 2nd, 2011. My name is Kelly Tafoya, and we're here today in Cole's Library with Gene Bryant. Now, where were you born and raised?
Muscatine, Iowa.
Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood?
I was the surprise child of a 62-year-old widower and a 41-year-old mother. It was one of those May-December things where, you know, nature took its course. My father died when I was not quite four of metastasized liver cancer, and my mother raised me, essentially, until in the south side of Muscatine, which, if you know anything about the logistics of that town, is extremely significant. You know, it literally is south of the tracks in every sense of the word. My mother remarried in 1956 when I was 10, and we moved uptown, which made quite a difference. One of the things that meant was that I had the benefit of the education in the secondary schools in Muscatine, which at that time was very good. Believe it or not, it was. And learned to read, learned to write effectively, learned to think to a great extent. Made a decision, was very, very much a part of the life of First Christian Church in Muscatine, of the Disciples of Christ. And made a decision to pursue ministry in that denomination probably in my junior, early in the senior year of high school. And what happened in those days, if you were a disciples ministerial candidate in Iowa, was you went to Drake, because it was founded by the disciples, and at that time had a seminary. I don't know if you students are familiar with the Medbury Hall over by the pharmacy school, but that was once Drake Divinity School. And the understanding between the university and the Iowa Society of Christian Churches was that it would produce the ministers that would then serve disciples' churches in Iowa. When Paul Sharp came to be president of the university, he found that school not meeting the standards that he held for the university and closed it. And that was in 1968, which happened to be the year I graduated, so I had to find somewhere else to go to seminary. But at any rate, that's how I got to Drake. I'd made the decision for ministry fairly late and had kind of, shall we say, had a good time in high school and not focused too much on the grades. And so I really didn't have the grades for admission, so I spent 2 years at Muscatine Community College, which is now part of Eastern Iowa Community College system, and got my grades up as best I could, and just kind of explored some new things. So admission to Drake was not a problem by the time I applied in late 65 or early 66. I graduated from there in 66 and came in largely on scholarships. Came out of Drake with only an $8,000 loan, which in those days was plenty, but it wasn't anywhere near what students of your generation are facing, that's for sure. And it was one of those national defense student loans where you had like 10 years to pay it off, and that worked out pretty well for us by and large. So that's a little bit of my background and how I got here.
What do you remember about moving into the dorm your first year here?
I remember making a conscious decision to live in one of the dorms rather than getting an apartment, because frankly I didn't want to be distracted by keeping house. My goal was, and I know it sounds lofty, but my goal was really to focus on what I was doing in classes and activities on the campus. It was a day when everybody was moving in. I was in Goodwin Kirk, which was a fairly new dorm in those days, but nothing fancy. I don't know how it is now, but it was fairly Spartan place. I was one of those rare students that was possessed of a stereo record player. Nowadays, of course, there were no computers in the rooms because they didn't exist for individuals. The TV was rare, and if there was one, it had rabbit ears. Most of us went downstairs to a big TV room and off the main lounge in the dormitory. And there were always big crowds for Star Trek, the original Star Trek, way back when, and Jeopardy, interestingly enough. The place would be packed for those programs. But, you know, anybody could go in and turn anything on that they wanted to, but there was always kind of a consensus that we'd show up and watch this kind of stuff. My roommate was from Webster Groves, Missouri, and was a freshman, and that was too big a gap between a junior and a freshman, and we ended that relationship halfway through the year. And I got a single, which worked out a whole lot better for me.
What are some of the highlights or things that you specifically remember about your first week of classes?
Of classes specifically or being on the campus?
Classes.
Probably the main thing I remember is how impressed, intimidated, excited, and delighted I was by Dale Miller, who was the head of the Department of Religion at that time, and philosophy. And everybody took his basic New Testament course that was interested in a major in any of those areas. And Dale came in, and one of the first things he said to us was, I'm going to help you unlearn everything you learned in Sunday school. Because, you know, we just got to get you past that in order for you to appreciate, you know, what I'm trying to tell you about Bible. That stuck with me, and I still remember it. He and I were talking about it the other day. In fact, we visited a little bit last summer. So that's probably the main thing I remember about classes. I don't remember if it was in that first week, if it was that semester or another one. It probably was another one when I had enrolled in Walter Brieman's History of Latin America course. And he was one of the most distinguished, elegant professors that the campus had. And I use the word advisedly. He always showed up immaculately dressed in a three-piece suit and wingtips and everything, exquisitely prepared, started class exactly on time, on to the minute, was never late, which was interesting in those days, lectured for exactly 40 minutes. We had 20 minutes or 10 minutes, I guess, for questions, and that was it. And somewhere in the course of that, there was a group of one of the issues on the campus in those days was the status of athletes. And the university was really struggling, I think, a little bit, looking back on it, with what the status of student athletes would be at Drake. Would it rise to the status of state universities where they're given free rides and easy classes and that kind of thing. And I think these football guys thought that was an easy class. So they were sitting in the back, along the back wall, kind of goofing around. After that first lecture, they were sitting there like this. And the next class, they were in the front row. That tells you something about the quality of that man's teaching.
Did you feel you were prepared for Drake? And why or why not?
I think I was prepared for it academically. As I said, I'd had a good background in reading and writing, in thinking. Never was much interested in or very good at math, so I avoided that stuff like the plague. I took what I had to. Economics I struggled with here under Dwight Saunders a little bit. The only F I ever got on a test was from Dwight in macroeconomics, because I just didn't get it, and I really had to work hard for it. But other things were, I wouldn't say easy, because it wasn't simple, but it came to me fairly well. The history classes, the classes in religion and philosophy. One of the things that Dale Miller was trying to do was to prepare us for a fairly demanding and sophisticated seminary education. So we did a lot of seminars, we did a lot of individual research and writing into things. We had to deal with some fairly significant issues in religion and Bible study and that kind of thing, and defend our positions. And so that was good preparation for seminary as well. My social skills and interests were not what I'd wish they could have been in those days. I'm an introvert by nature, believe it or not. Most people are surprised when a pastor tells them that, but many of us are. And I probably kept to myself more than I should have. I was never the kind of guy that the Greeks would recruit. but I didn't get terribly involved in some other things either, except the campus ministry program, whose house is now gone. I think that probably has been folded into some other things that the university does now. And eventually got involved in student academic leadership. Trying to remember what it was called, but there was an academic council in the university. I don't know if that still exists or not or anything like that. But I was actually asked to take a seat on that. And that was a real exciting and growth-producing experience because I think Dr. Sharp really was committed to hearing the input from students in those days. And so maybe we helped make a positive contribution.
What were your impressions of Henry Harmon and Frederick Sharp, the two presidents during your stay?
I don't remember Henry Harmon at all, period. I mean, he may have welcomed us or addressed us at some point. Being a transfer student, I might not have been included in the welcome to the freshman or whatever. I remember Paul Sharp as very focused, very clear about what his goals were for the university. The famous quote attributed to him was that Drake should be the Harvard of the Midwest. And he meant it. That wasn't just PR. And he was pretty rigorous, I think, at trying to pursue excellence across the university. As I mentioned, he was instrumental in closing the Divinity School because he didn't believe that the quality of education there rose to the level that the university should have. I only was with him one or two times, probably through the academic council stuff, but he seemed to be a man of gentle good humor as well, and seemed to be well liked by and large.
What can you tell us about the United Campus Christian Fellowship?
No, you looked me up, didn't you? UCCF was probably the focus of my outside the dorm stuff. I and three or four friends used to hang out there all the time. It was an old house. Shoot, I didn't remember what street it was on now, but it was back up near Carpenter someplace or something like that. I'm sure it's gone now, probably incorporated for the Dial Center or something like that. And it was just, it was a place where we hung. The campus minister, who was Wayne Bryan at the time, Presbyterian pastor, had his office in there, and you could find him a lot of the time, but most of the time, we just would show up, and it became a favorite study spot. The crash on the sofa and do your reading for whatever you had to do, catch a nap if you needed to, or something like that. But perhaps the most important thing from the standpoint of my personal life I remember about UCCF was that was the first place I laid eyes on my wife. She had come into Drake in 65 as a freshman, and so she'd been here a year. She was starting her second year and was also active in UCCF, and I showed up there the first night I was on campus. And we met each other at that time, but it took a while for anything to develop beyond that. But it was like we'd seen each other, knew each other. There used to be Sunday night dinners because the dining hall didn't serve anything on Sunday nights. Is it still that way?
No.
No. Okay, that's a pleasant change, I guess. But they gave all the staff Sunday nights off. And so you were on your own for that, and students did a variety of things, but at UCCF we had dinners, and different people were in charge of getting the food for those and fixing the dinners and all that kind of thing. And Wayne, shall we say, arranged for Linda and myself to be a team every time that came up. And that was one of the ways that we found out that we were pretty good at working together and that we enjoyed each other's company. And so one thing kind of led to another. We weren't the only couple like that that Wayne had something to do with. I don't think he would call himself a matchmaker, but he understood people pretty well.
What rules did you have to follow to live in the residence halls?
At that time, The residence halls were not coeducational. They were strictly men and women. The access of the opposite sex in the dorms was strictly regulated, especially in the women's dorms. There were visiting hours. At least some of the time I was here, men were allowed to meet women only in the lounges downstairs. You couldn't go on the floor. That might have changed a little bit during that time, because I seem to remember going up to visit one girlfriend, but the rule was that the doors had to be open all the time. And if you came up, you had to say very loudly, "Man on the floor," so everybody knew. I remember those. No smoking, no drink, no alcohol in the rooms or anything like that. A restriction that I can assure you was routinely violated all the time. But those were the rules. There were house mothers or house parents. You got those? Yeah, well, we had them too. So those are a few of the rules.
What can you tell us about a dress code?
Nothing for men. Well, wait a minute. Yeah, there was. Appropriate dress was kind of the thing, especially for men, but it was unequal as far as the sexes went. Linda could tell you more about this, and probably is if she's being asked the same questions. Women were required to watch the length of their skirts, as I recall. In the winter time, I think was the only time they were allowed to wear slacks, as I recall, just as a protection against the cold. There was a strict dress code for Hubble, especially on the weekends. You had to dress appropriately, and if you came like to lunch on Sunday, men were supposed to wear a jacket and tie, this kind of thing. And one of my strongest recollections of that was sitting in the dining room at Hubble, appropriately dressed. Remember, I'd been to church anyway, so it wasn't a big deal for me, but it was for a lot of people, I think. And one of our, shall we say, more adventurous students, male students, was observed coming down the sidewalk wearing a beautiful sport jacket, white shirt, necktie, blue jeans, and barefoot. But he met the dress code.
What types of groups or memberships were you involved in on campus besides UCCF?
I mentioned a couple of those, but those were probably the main ones for me.
What kind of things did you do off campus for entertainment?
Went to movies mostly. I'm still a big movie fan, especially when I was single and wasn't going out or anything on a night. I'd often cut out and go to a movie. That was my favorite way of relaxing when, the academic pressure was getting ramped up and stuff like that. I was pretty familiar with most of the movie houses around, including the Ingersoll Theater, which isn't there anymore. I mean, the building is, but the theater isn't there anymore.
Describe some of your close friendships with others on campus.
One of my closest friends when I was a student here was a young man from Metuchen, New Jersey, named Alan Kreitzberg. Alan had transferred in too, like me, so maybe that was how we first found a connection. He transferred in from Buena Vista in Storm Lake. And we also got involved together at UCCF and would hang out quite a bit together. We lived in the same dorm, although I don't think it was on the same floor, and had several classes together, religion classes together, and would often, hang in each other's rooms and kick around ideas and that kind of thing, just the usual college stuff. I'd largely lost track of Alan for about 40 years until he surfaced again through Dr. Miller. And we had a long phone conversation last summer, got caught up on what's going on. He's been a social worker in Grand Rapids, Michigan for years, very effective apparently. And I'm not surprised. He really had the sensitivity for that. one or two other faces went through my mind, and they're slipping. Oh dear, that happens. You know how that goes. I may think of somebody. If I do, I'll come back to it.
Okay. What were some events that you attended that stand out in your mind as memorable that were on campus?
That were on campus?
Yes.
One of them was that every year we had a religious emphasis week, and remember, there were only two of those in my experience here. But one of them in particular I remember was when Madeline Murray O'Hare came to campus as part of Religious Emphasis Week, who was at that time kind of the leader of American atheists. She was also psychotic, and that became pretty evident in what she was doing in her speech. And that was my first exposure to the really radical fringe, you know, of the American religious scene. Since then, it's there's been considerably more exposure in that way. But listening to her speak was, you know, was kind of a formative sort of experience. George Lincoln Rockwell, the head of the American Nazis, was also here, I think, as part of Religious Emphasis Week. He was assassinated not too long after that. You got to remember that the mid and late 60s were a tumultuous time in American life. I don't know how much your generation is being made aware of that, but by the time I graduated, the country was so polarized there was no middle ground left over the Vietnam War and similar things. So one or two things that stand out in my memory were a student power demonstration on the lawn in front of Old Main with the usual sloganeering and everything like that. I think President Sharp dealt with that fairly and met with the students and did the best that he could, as far as I know, but it was a pretty heady kind of thing. Another memory I have is in the spring of 1968 joining an anti-war march downtown. We met downtown and marched up, I think, Grand Avenue to the steps of the Capitol. And the negative memory of that was the guy who worked the fringe of the crowd offering us gas and matches to immolate ourselves in protest against the war. He carried a sign saying free gas and matches for peace creeps. I tried to talk with him about why he felt that way and didn't make much progress in that one. But the positive memory from that was when we got to the steps of the Capitol, Governor Hughes, Harold Hughes, came out and spoke with us. And our respect for Governor Hughes was enormous. He was highly regarded and was being considered as a candidate for the presidency at that point. Instead, he chose to not to seek re-election as governor, and essentially to retire to be a kind of United Methodist monk after a fashion to pursue a spiritual life. He was influential, but to have him come out and listen to us and speak to us, you know, and show sympathy for what was on our minds and say, you know, we're hearing you, you know, I'm talking with thus and such, you know, the senator, this senator or that representative about what your concerns are, was impressive. The other the other major event from a personal standpoint was being chosen for Phi Beta Kappa in the spring of 1968. And the way that came about was involved one of the other friends whose name slipped my mind a minute ago, a Jewish guy from Chicago named Jay Shukart, who lived upstairs from me, almost exactly upstairs from me. And he used to come down sometimes and knock on my door, and I'd say, come on in, and he'd kind of toss it open, and he'd say, hey, Rabbi, what's up, you know? And we had a going time. We enjoyed each other immensely, I think. But Jay, the names of the people who were to be inducted into Phi Beta Kappa was published someplace. I don't know if it was the Times Delphic or where. But when I read it, you know, I went upstairs to see if Jay was home, and he was, and I congratulated him on that and said, man, that's great. You know, nobody deserves it more than you, you know, because he really was a terrific student. and stuff. And he was from Chicago. I don't know if I said that, but we used to talk about Chicago all the time and how it was different from Des Moines. I never got to Chicago until I was in my early 20s, so that was quite an experience. But anyway, after all of that, and it was time to go to dinner, I went by to check my mailbox downstairs. I don't know if they still have those or not, but you had your own individual mail. Pulled that thing open, and there was a registered letter, and the registered letter said, "Oops, we left you off the list, but you're to be inducted into Phi Beta Kappa too." So I saw Jay in Hubble and walked over and said, "Look at this." And he said, "Wow, so that was kind of an upper all the way around." And I'm still very grateful for that honor. And I've continued to be active in Phi Beta Kappa in one way or another, especially in the last few years.
Can you tell us about breaking the Greek hold on campus?
Oh, funny you would ask about that. I'm tempted to ask why you're asking. Is it okay to tell me, or should I guess?
You can guess.
I can guess. If that's a part of the well-known history of Drake, that's interesting. If it's because you researched my involvements, that's another matter. There was a lot of concern by the time I got to Drake, and I began to pick it up here and there, especially living in a residence hall, because most of the Greeks lived off campus. In fact, I think virtually all of them did. And no offense, Alpha Phi, but the concern was not that there were fraternities and sororities. The concern was that from the perspective, and remember these student power days. The concern was that from the perspective of other students, the Greeks controlled the life of the university. They were in charge of every significant student organization there was. And that began to chafe. There was a sense of, yeah, we ought to battle this kind of entrenched stuff going on. And so there was a real movement to try to break the Greek hold over the life of the campus. And it took different forms. I only saw little bits of it, but what I did see, and I was sympathetic to it by and large. What I did see was the creation of DISA, or the Drake Independent Students Association, which was deliberately called together to try to offer an alternative to Greeks involved in these campus organizations. I think it was largely successful, and that could have been one of the ways I got on the seminary academic, or not seminary, but university academic. I was on the seminary academic council too, but that's another story, with a university, because I was an independent, who was willing to do it. But we did, different stuff like, we would go to the bookstore and we would buy the Greek letters that you could buy at that time that people put on their car windows. And we would buy Gamma Delta Iota. That was our fraternity, Goddamned Independent. And we proudly displayed them on our cars, in my case on my motorbike, on similar things like that. We occasionally got told how people felt about it. There were signs up in the men's and ladies' rooms in the call in the dormitories. So it became quite a big deal, I think, on campus. And it looks like it was largely successful by and large. I mean, I don't know what the status of Greek involvement is now. So I don't think the concern was as much that fraternities and sororities existed. None of us had any problem with their right to exist or people's right to belong to them. I think we did have a concern with Drake becoming an elitist institution. I think that was the concern in those days.
On a lighter note, what were some memorable stories you have about your wife and at Drake?
I think I realized that I was interested in Linda in ways that went beyond just friendship or saying hi or this kind of thing. As I spent more and more time working with her, as Wayne put us together more, and then we began to find ways to get together otherwise, I can't say that we did a lot of formal, what you would call dating or anything like that. It wasn't that kind of atmosphere on the campus. We just got together a lot and did stuff. One of the things that she reminds me of is that I used to get up to go to the earliest breakfast because she did. She had a lot of early classes, And being an organ major in fine art, she had to get up really early to get practice time. Well, I'm not a morning person. I wasn't then. I'm not now. If anything I took in 8 o'clock classes probably went straight through the holes in my head. And I'd love to see somebody do doctoral research on what the connection is between, not being morning people and what you retain from early morning classes. But anyway, I bet you there's a correlation. But I would get up and go to the dining hall so I could see her, and we'd hang and this kind of thing. I started getting invited along when she was going with friends. She had a car, I did not. So very often she would invite me to go like out to Merle Hay Mall, which was the only mall in town at the time, if we needed to do shopping or something like that. Things like that. I began to help her maintain the car and that kind of stuff a little bit, because I knew a little bit about that kind of stuff. We began to spend a lot of time together pretty much through the winter of 67 to 68. And we did go out quite a bit to movies and that kind of stuff on the weekends. You got to remember that an organ major had a lot of work to do. They really had to do a lot of practicing. They had to go to a lot of recitals. So it wasn't like she had tons of free time, so we had to work it in any way we could. And we did, pretty much. I was beginning to wonder, at least in my own mind, about what I wanted to do about this relationship, where it was going. She was going to graduate in January. She was ahead of the curve. I was going to graduate in May, and was already planning to go to seminary in Nashville. And I wondered, what do we do about this? And she was being actively urged to go to Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York, where an awful lot of first-rate organists go. And we talked about it a little bit, and she kind of sent signals indirectly that she'd be open to modifying that plan somewhat if she got the right offer. And then April of 68 came. And I think it was a spring break, I think. And neither one of us was going home. She had a job, and I think I did too, or I wasn't going home for some reason, and I was in the dorm. And I thought, I'm just going to call her up and see if she's doing anything with all of this. And I was literally reaching for the telephone, and it rang, and it was her. And she essentially asked me out. I love to tell our children this. She said, "Would you like to go to the Itzhak Perelman concert tonight at Vets?" And I said, "Yeah, sure, why not?" Well, that was the same day that Martin Luther King was killed. And we were just walking around like, what the heck has happened? And in a daze. And when we got to Vets, we got in our seats, and Itzhak Perelman, who is physically handicapped, worked his way out onto the stage with his crutches. And he said, "I'm going to change my program in honor of Dr. King." And he's a violinist, and he played very different things. That memory is very vivid in both of us, to this day. It might have been that same day that I asked her to marry me, or it might have been later on, but we'd been talking quite a bit about it. But I did kind of the conventional thing, whether I didn't get down on one knee, but I said, "Please marry me." And so she said, "Okay." And we got going.
Can you tell us about some of the memories you have about your graduation ceremony?
Not many. It was in Drake Stadium, I think in May or June of 68, something like that. There were lots of us. One thing that we did do was that I invited my family from Muscatine and that area to come to Des Moines. And some of them had never been in Des Moines before, so that was kind of, believe it or not, so that was kind of an adventure for them a little bit. And I reserved a room. I think it was at Bishop's Cafeteria. Maybe there might have been a Bishop's here at one time somewhere in the area, and we all got together and had a meal together. I remember Dale and Betty came, my major prof and his wife. And but that was when we also told everybody, you know, Linda and I were engaged. So that was the announcement to my birth family anyway at that point. But they still remember that. They still talk about it. I was talking with my by now very elderly cousin who came, and she was reminiscing about that. So that was kind of a nice time, kind of a pleasant thing.
Is there anything you would have done differently while at Drake?
I don't know how it could have happened given the realities, but if I could have done anything differently, I would have had 4 years here instead of two. But it didn't work out that way. But I enjoyed those 2 years so immensely. They were so rich that I wish there could have been four of them. Maybe that would have changed everything. I don't know. But yeah, I would like to have found out.
What did you do right after you graduated from Drake?
Right after I graduated from Drake, I took a job in Glen Echo Christian Church, which I'm sure you've heard of, at Beaver and Douglas. I'd become very good friends with a senior pastor there because Dale had invited me to go with him as kind of a group leader when he was doing Bible study with their congregation in a retreat setting. And I fell in love with the pastor and a lot of the people and started going to church there pretty much all through my senior year, and thoroughly enjoyed it. And they'd always had a student associate minister. And so I said, well, look, you know, Tom is leaving and Mike isn't coming until next fall. Can I work for you during the summer and keep something going for the kids? And then I never heard anything, and I never heard anything. And then I was in the bathroom one Sunday morning, and one of the elders came in and he said, "Oh, I'm glad you're going to be with us this summer." Well, that's nice to know. But I was, and I had a really good time working with them, just kind of keeping the kids together. We did dances and retreats and stuff like that. So that was what I did immediately after graduation. I mean, immediately. That also kept me in Des Moines because Linda was here. And that wasn't a bad thing. That fall, I entered seminary at Vanderbilt Divinity School in Nashville.
What words of wisdom would you offer to this year's senior class?
I think it would, in some ways, would be arrogant for me to presume to tell your generation what they ought to be keeping in mind. Things have changed so drastically since I was a student here. You live in a different world. And I think perhaps without the optimism that we had, that the world was as malleable as we thought it would be, I think your generation is maybe a little more aware of how intractable some problems and some people can be. In that respect, you're probably more realistic than we were in many ways. And I don't mean to put us down, you know, because you deal with things from the perspective of where you are. But I guess the main thing would be, you know, look actively for things that give you hope for the future, for your own lives. Be patient, and let your lives unfold as, dare I say, God would have them unfold, you know, from a Christian perspective, which is my perspective, but not everyone else's. And stay open to all kinds of possibilities. And yet, you know, even saying something like that, you know, it feels terribly arrogant because of the way the economy is, you know, the job situation now, you know, where we are, it's different for you than it was for us. So we had pretty easy time finding jobs in those days. There wasn't much difficulty, the kind of difficulty that there is now. But maybe another thing that I just tack on would be, don't be afraid if you see injustice, things that you know are wrong, that have to be wrong, to speak out and try to do something. The contemporary example of that, of course, is the Occupy movement that's going on now across the nation. the news media is going crazy because they can't slot that into any one of their convenient little boxes anywhere. It's something that was probably inevitable, you know, given the way things are. But it may become a force to be reckoned with by the people who are making decisions about our national life at this point, and who's going to have it and who isn't, because that's what it's come down to for us right now. Since 1980, we have been pursuing, you know, a me first kind of approach to everything. I'm going to get what I want. I'll get what I want. I can have it all, you know, this kind of thing, and all of that. And that way of living is not sustainable, and the chickens are coming home to roost. That may be the shape of the world that your generation's going to have to live in post-college.
Is there anything else you would like to add as our final question?
I hope that anything I've said has been helpful to you and to your project. I am interested in knowing a little more about your project. You know, tell me a little bit about what this project is. I know I read your leaders' emails and all that, but remind me.
We've been learning a lot lately about oral histories and their importance.
Uh-huh.
We've traveled to the state archives and learned the importance of learning from the past in order to help and preserve the future.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to help with preserving some of Drake's history, we wanted to record some oral histories so that your stories and other stories can be remembered by people later.
Okay, and what class is this, or program?
This is Drakepedia. It's a first-year seminar for incoming freshmen.
Mm-hmm.
And it pretty much teaches us the different resources we have at Drake and how to learn and write and just mm-hmm. think critically. Mm-hmm. It's kind of our introduction to the rest of our classes at Drake.
Okay, so you are freshmen. Okay. Interesting approach to, you know, diving into the pool of the university. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, this is something new. I was surprised and delighted to hear about it because there's an awful lot being done with oral history. One of the things that I learned to do in congregations as time went on, because congregations face the same kinds of generational issues that go on, was to learn to go and interview the members, especially the ones that have been around for a while. And then get the members to interview each other, you know, kind of a little bit, to hear each other's stories. And it's amazing how much that can reduce the tensions that go on in a congregation when change slams into them like a sledgehammer and the old ways of doing things don't work anymore. They can appreciate that whatever the generational differences are, the thing they have in common is a love for the congregation. Same thing can be true with the university. I'm grateful to be a Drake alum. Not all the directions the university has changed in the last 40 years have pleased me. I'm not happy about the de-emphasis in liberal arts, for instance. And Linda's certainly not happy with the decision to dismantle the organ program. That is, in our opinion, that's the university going the wrong way, and I don't care who hears that. That has implications for our decisions about giving as alumni. You know, we think those things are important and should be perpetuated by and large. I'm not saying that the liberal arts are totally ignored. I mean, you know, your program is obviously there, but as I heard some Drake representatives in the late 80s and early 90s talking about the plans for the university, the message largely seemed to be, we're going to try to get those kids who want to make a lot of money and show them how they can do it. That's legitimate up to a point, but part of the purpose of a college education is to teach you how to think critically, to evaluate, to listen carefully, and to be productive citizens across the whole arc of your lives. That's a tall order, but that's what the university's bitten off, and I don't think it should forget about it.
Well, we greatly appreciate your time, and thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.